Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. And for about the last 25 years, we've all worked with just about every major publisher in the business. We published somewhere around 50 to 100 books, and we've all taught illustration at the universities.
Every week we chat about different issues in illustration. Sometimes we argue, sometimes we agree, but most of the time we just have fun.
That's right. All right, so today, is there any house cleaning we need to do? Any business that we need to take care of? I don't think so.
We're just all kind of dealing with this pandemic thing right now.
Yeah, people are sick of that. I shouldn't use that.
Yeah, it's coming out. This is in middle. You said it's in the middle of May, right? So I think everything by the time you guys hear this, the life is good. There's not even anything to talk about with that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Right? Yeah, we're recording this at the end of March. March sometime, and we're just a little bit ahead of schedule. We try to do things a little bit ahead of schedule around here.
Maybe we say one optimistic thing because everybody's all doom and gloom. I'll tell you the one bright side of the past 2 weeks, which have been, pretty crazy in the world. But for me, I actually have had the time to get my shelves and drawers in order. You know how there's some things you just never have time to actually get around to? And so what ends up happening, and what I mean, I don't mean like for my clothes and stuff, I mean work-related stuff. And so what happens is I go to do a painting, say, for example, and I can't find a canvas, or I can't find the paper, or I think that I'm out, and I go buy another, set of supplies, and then I find the one that I just didn't store correctly later. And so I end up with all this stuff, and it actually takes a lot of resources to find stuff and to say I get a print order. Well, what's been printed and what hasn't been printed, stuff isn't put back in the right place. And so I took 2 days and I organized everything, my garage, my studio storage, which I have a separate storage unit for, and it's just all labeled and categories. And oh, it's great. It's so good.
That's good. I actually found myself organizing my hard drive for the same reason.
Same thing, yeah. Same thing.
It's just like I have all this this work that I've done and reference folders and everything, and just some good stuff in there and things that I've forgotten about, and I've just been going through and kind of picking through and putting things in the right folders and renaming files so that they make more sense and easier to find and all that stuff. So.
That's good.
Yep.
It feels nice, doesn't it? When you're done with that stuff, there's a weird level of satisfaction with it.
It does. So today I want to talk about books. And this actually came in. We had someone email us and just said, hey, you guys are always talking about books. Can you guys do, books that you've referenced or that you've got a quote from or this or that, dealing with different topics that we've talked about. And they just asked, could you do an episode where you talk about your favorite books? And so I thought that was a great idea. And I wanted to ask you guys, we'll start, you guys are working illustrators, professional illustrators. I want to know, was there a children's book, either growing up or sometime in your formative years, or a series of books, or a particular creator who made books that inspired you to become an illustrator? If not, then after you became an illustrator, you have drawn inspiration from. So I'm just curious for you two, what that would be. Either one of you. If you want to think about it for a little bit, I've got a few.
Now you're the question you're asking right now is formative years kind of stuff, like not what we're looking at now, but like something early on that kind of sparked something.
Yeah, I'm just, we'll ease into this and then we'll get to some more contemporary or things that are affecting us right now.
I got a good one. This okay, one, so growing up, I didn't read a lot. I was outdoor person. If you guys have been listening to the podcast in the past, you guys know that I grew up very active. I mean, the full-on outdoor kid playing in the woods kind of thing. I never came in. I didn't want to read. There was only one book that made it through all of my childhood and then made it to my bookshelves as an adult, and it was called The Pink Elephant with Golden Spots. And this thing is dog-eared and it's beat up, but somehow that one made it all the way. I'm looking for the, it was published in 1970. And so it's an old one. I don't know how it ended up even at my house, but it's this Pink Elephant with Golden Spots. It's this fantastic story. It starts with a wardrobe and these three kids playing, and they open the wardrobe, and somehow they get to wish, similar to, I guess, Lion. What's the Lion, the Witch and Wardrobe, whatever. But they get to wish on it. It's not a land or anything like that. They get to wish on it. And one kid wishes for one thing, and they don't, a big giant cake, and they don't, and then the next kid cancels that one out and wishes for this sports car. And this sports car that came out of the wardrobe, I'll never forget that spread. It had a huge globe on it, on the car, and all the smoke coming out of it. And it was just one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. And I mean, I'm just blown away. As a kid, I just remember being so enthralled by that illustration. And then ultimately the third person wishes for a pink elephant with golden spots, which breaks the wardrobe and gets the story going. And the rest of the story is super cool too. But just that car coming out of there, that is the basis of my whole illustration and art career.
Wow. Hmm. So it all comes back to like, because your illustrations have so much like whimsy to them, so much imagination to them. So it does come back to that, like your wiring of your brain from that illustration.
It changed everything. I mean, the key kind of common denominator is like this regular world, then with one thing that changes that's magical. So it's not like this crazy topsy-turvy world. It's basically a normal world with one thing that's slightly changed or different, you know?
Yeah. Mm. I like that, because that was one of your rules we talked about a few episodes ago. Like, how do you, what was our episode on how to be more creative, or how to find more creativity in your work? That's cool. What about you, Will?
You know, I think that the books that you grow up with, I mean, I can tell you right now, the reason I'm an illustrator is because of my relationship with images. Growing up, I was a reluctant reader, or they would classify me as a reluctant reader today. I hated reading. If I could be an adult in a child's body and they'd say, "You're kind of a reluctant reader," I'd just say, "No, I freaking hate reading." I learned to love reading later on, but I would get books. I would just check books out based on the illustrations and just look at the illustrations. And some of those books, some of them we owned. I have a list here. I'll just read through them really quick. Go Dog Go by P.D. Eastman and Duck Feet by P.D. Eastman. Love those. And would just look at the pictures and just dream. And I would get the story or the gist of it from the images. Blueberries for Sal by Robert McCloskey. Where the Wild Things Are, Mari Sendak, which is obviously a very popular book. Two books that a lot of people probably haven't ever seen unless they are from Japan are Isambashi, and I hope I'm saying that right, and Urashima Taro. And you know, our friend Jed Henry actually illustrated Urashima Taro. I don't know if you knew that, Jed, or Jake. That. Yeah. I don't know why he did it, but they're on, if you Google, you'll come up with some of his popping. Anyway, and the Francis books by Russell Hoban. But I think that everybody who wants to be a children's book illustrator probably is going to have their own concoction of books that they grew up with or reasons why they were inspired. I remember specifically in each one of those stories, there was a very And I would guess one of the reasons why each one of those are very popular books and still selling today is they really hit an emotional chord, you know? And so the image is really tied to my emotions. And when I think of those books, I feel those same emotions I did when I was a kid. And as an illustrator today, that's what I hope to be able to do as I'm illustrating. I think of the kids that are going to look at my books and I ask myself, am I able to create those same kinds of emotions? Am I really able to sell this story? I'm given the manuscript.
Right.
can I do it justice? Can I, what can I do to enhance this so that the kids like me who didn't want to read.
Now, do you think you've hit that moment? I mean, is there any book that reaches that level for you that when you look back on your library that you've done?
I hope so. I mean, I feel like it, at least in parts of all my books, I've done that. I'm really happy with the Bonaparte books. The new ones came out this month, Bonaparte Plays Ball, which is now available on your local bookstore, hopefully, and at least on Amazon. That's what I really tried to do. I really tried to go beyond the text and really try to sell the feelings and the emotions and the narrative of what's actually happening.
Do you think the text, since you aren't a writer, do you think the text has been strong enough to equal that?
On those books, yes. On some of the projects I've had, no. And I know why you're asking.
Look this way.
Well, no, I know some of the discussions we've had about books and some of the manuscripts that have come across your desk just feel are weak sometimes. Can I say
I just used to think that I could save it with illustration, and now I realize it's got to be in unison. The hand in hand images and text need to go together as a cohesive thing. I can't save a story that isn't a story or isn't mm-hmm. you know, doesn't have that potential. And I don't know right. if I've had the right text yet to do that.
I feel like I finally was able to find my you're trying to find your style or your voice, and you have a style, and I feel like I was getting there. I was sort of meandering my way through these children's books that I've done, but it wasn't until The 12 Sleighs of Christmas where I felt like that is a Jake Parker book, and that book was I got to do it in pen and ink. I got to color, I got to color in my sort of my flat coloring style, but the subject matter was all these elves had to design each a different sleigh. And there was like a bulldozer sleigh and a hot rod sleigh and a flying saucer sleigh. And they all were trying to like improve upon Santa's sleigh because Santa's sleigh was damaged. And that just allowed me to go bananas with what I wanted to do as a illustrator within the confines of a children's book. And I remember there was one spread where I was sitting there drawing it. I was like, this is it. This is what I would want to see in a children's book as a kid. And it was a spread where all the elves had to like separate and each work on their project in groups. And what I did was I just did this over the head angle of all these different groups of elves, and they had these partitions set up so that nobody could see what the other one was doing. But then in each different section, you know, I drew like schematics and like weird engine pieces getting put together and elves like carrying supplies back and forth. And it was just a fun spread to like kind of, I mean, it was nowhere near a Where's Waldo type of thing, but it was, so, you know, my version of what I could get.
So you felt it while you're doing it. You're like, this is it started to really kind of float your boat, as it were, as you're making it. That's so funny that you say that, because we were just reading the Little Bot book mm-hmm. two nights ago, and Little I was just Bot thinking to myself, yeah, it's so different than that style. And I was, you know, we were actually talking about that because, you know, my son's starting to draw and stuff. And we're just talking about, you know, line work versus fully painted scenes and stuff like that. And we're talking about that, you know, like which way do you go? Some projects just naturally push you towards whatever the finished style is. So, but it's just interesting how different those books are.
Yeah. And I go back to, I didn't say what my, like my inspiration from, or I guess the books I loved as a kid were the Richard Scarry books, which was just a lot of busy things happening at the same time, and like walls peeled back from buildings and little vehicles and things like that. I loved those things. And then I also loved there's two books in particular, Danny and the Dinosaur. I don't know if you guys remember that one, but this kid goes to a museum And one of the dinosaurs at, you know, one of the like dinosaur statues was actually alive and acknowledges Danny, and Danny and this dinosaur like head out of the museum together and just kind of go around the town.
Oh, that's like, awesome.
Doing all the things you would do with the dinosaur. So there was that. And then there was a book called Little Toot. It was about this tiny little tugboat. The illustrations were just phenomenal, but I just loved, I don't know. I just loved, there's a page in there where it was like this map of the bay that the boat was in, and you could kind of see where the boat had gone and around and where it had been. And I always loved like those over the top views, schematic kind of images of what we're experiencing in the book.
Yeah.
All those sorts of things I play into what I love doing in children's books now, even though a lot of my books haven't reflected that. But I think moving forward, more of that stuff is going to, I think, hopefully the projects that I get and that I work on align more so with those tastes.
Do you think this is a weird, like, I don't want to derail the conversation too much, but do you think our whole career is spent trying to basically recreate that awesome thing that we saw as a kid, and yeah, we're just striving for that one moment?
I do. You know,
I think, it could be. That could be part of it.
That's
right?
Funny.
I've talked about this a lot of times before on podcasts and my YouTube channel, but the scene that I remember going back to as a child that I have distinct memories of, you get stuck on something in your life for a while and it's something that you do every day or, you know, for a period of time. I don't know how long the duration was, but I would come home from school and I would grab that Go Dog Go book and I'd flip to the last picture in there. Uh-huh. Which was the dog party at the top of the tree, which is like, it's so fantastical because you can't exist and play on top of a tree.
Right.
So just that image of, you know, and I'll describe it because it's a podcast, but you can look it up pretty easily. If you type in Go Dog Go, last seen tree or something like that. And it's this huge tree. And our point of view is high up looking down on top of the tree, and the tree is broad and the leaves are so dense that you can walk on them.
Right.
And there's dogs up there playing tennis and
it's
they're
like
playing
little kid logic.
Yeah. Right? It's amazing. And, so I mean, that was burned into my brain. And when I did the first Bonaparte book, Bonaparte Falls Apart, I channeled that for the last scene in the book. The last scene in the book had like two words, I think, of type, and I can't remember what the words are, but there was no description of what the resolution was. Mm-hmm. You know, no direction at all, which I love.
Yeah.
And it was basically all the characters coming together and it was it's the denouement. So it's resolved, everyone's having fun, everyone's at peace. And I thought, I'm going to do that tree scene in at the end of Go Dog Go. And I did a jungle gym with all these characters playing and just having fun, doing different things. And so it really did. I mean, I really was an homage to that.
Now, are you now that you got to do that one, are you done with that? Or does it come back in different forms? I mean, it's funny because Jake just said the same thing. He said his favorite image as a kid was that that dense stuff where he's looking around for this thing. And then his favorite image that he did now in the sleigh book is the one that's almost the same as that, right? The descriptions are exactly the same.
Yeah. I don't think I'll ever get it out of my system. I'll probably just keep creating the same types of images.
Artists tend to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, they create this just different versions of almost the same image. It's weird.
Yeah.
No, and I think if you are listening to this and you're struggling to find your style or to find your voice, one thing you could do is try to remember back, what was it that got you excited as a kid looking at illustrations, looking at books? Maybe you watched a lot of cartoons. What was it in the cartoons that got you excited? Or what was it in video games that got you excited as a kid? And try to channel that into what you're doing now and see if it can't be, you know, it can't be some source of inspiration to guide your work and to affect how you actually create. I want to ask you guys what books should every illustrator read and why? Like, if you're a working illustrator, you're aspiring to be a working illustrator, what books should you read and why? And I have three different categories here. And if you don't have a book for each category, that's fine. I have one for each category, but it'd be cool if you did. First category is, what books should you read for inspiration? I guess books that would help you along your creative journey as far as inspiring you to create and to be a creator. What books should every illustrator read as far as like business, the business side of it? Because that's an illustrator, you're half business person, half creative person, right? And then the last one is craft. What book should every artist read for or refer to for craft? So I'll start with inspiration and then we'll move from there. And for me, there's two books that that I've read over within the last 3 or 4 years, and I keep referring back to them. They're all marked up, they're dog-eared, and I go back to them and I actually use quotes from these books and little snippets and ideas from these books for my YouTube videos, for my blog posts, and things that I'm just thinking about and working on writing, and even in conversation with other artists, like I'll bring these things up to kind of help other artists and inspire them and inspire myself. And the first one is The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. This book isn't for everybody, but it was for me. It was for me.
What's it called? The War of Art?
The War of Art.
Isn't that where he talks about the resistance in there?
Yeah. So the first half of the book is all about resistance. And he's a screenwriter for Hollywood. He wrote The Legend of Bagger Vance. I think that was his big one, plus a bunch of other ones. And, you know, worked on a lot of these screenwriters will come in and work on a few pages here and there, and whether or not they get a credit for it, they'll get paid for it. But so he's been in and out of Hollywood. He's done novels and things like that. And so he comes at it from a writer's perspective, but everything he talks about really applies to any creative pursuit. And his main thing is there's in between you and the work that you want to make is resistance. And here's all the different forms that it comes in. And here's all the different ways you can overcome it. And it's less like, you know, science shows that a habit is formed in X amount of days and you should do it, go about it. It's less that. And it's more like, it's just more inspirational. It's more, some of it's tongue in cheek, but a lot of it is, you know, look at it from this perspective. You know, if you're in the boxing rink and you're expecting not to get hit, then why are you in the rink at all? Right. You know, you should be, or I guess it's not a rink. That's a hockey rink.
Yeah.
Boxing ring.
I was going to get points for correcting you, but, you caught it.
But it's, you know, it's stuff like that. Like, you know, you're going to show up for the fight, then be prepared for it, be ready, you know, stuff like, so I love it. And I really look to that book. And then I have another one too, unless you guys have a couple of books that you draw inspiration from.
Go ahead, keep going, and then we'll take our turn.
Okay. And the other one is Art and Fear. And
we got Art and War, and now we got Art and Fear.
No, the right. War of Since Art the- and Art and Fear.
Mixed martial arts for the artist.
I forgot who wrote this. So this one, the subtitle is Observations on the Perils and Rewards of Art Making by David Bales and Ted Orland. And this has, it's basically another thing that keeps people from being the best artist they could be is fear. And so this just kind of goes through, just kind of unpacks that whole idea, like what are you afraid of? What is causing this fear? Why should you create, even though you are fearful? You know, you are afraid of what the outcome might be. It's really good. It was one of those books where I couldn't sit down and just read through it. It's short. It's 120 pages. It took me a year to read because I could only read a page at a time because I'd have to like stop and just think about it and like let that simmer for a day or two and then go back and read the next page and kind of work through it that way. Here's one quote from it. The function of the overwhelming majority of your artwork is simply to teach you how to make the small fraction of your artwork that soars. And that kind of goes back to what we were saying with our illustration books. It's like a lot of this artwork was the purpose of it. Yes, we got paid for it, but it took us a lot of artwork to get through to find that artwork that really, like they say in this book, that soars. That artwork that really is in tune with who we are and what we want to create and also gets the job done as far as the illustration side of it, you know? So I recommend those two books.
I haven't heard of either one of those books. I'm going to check those out because I'm looking for new stuff.
Yeah.
Going to recommend a book I read in college and then I go back to it a lot. And it's funny because as I change in my career, the writing means different things to me each time I read it, but it's all applicable to no matter where I am. Mm-hmm. It's really good. This is The Artist's Spirit by Robert Henri.
Mm.
You guys know that one?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, it's good. It's really good. It's old. I mean, he's you know, contemporary of, you know, John Singer Sargent and, you know, that era. Mm-hmm. But it's good. It's really just about the idea of what it means to be an artist. And I'm going to give you a little quote right in the beginning that sort of sums up the rest of the book. It says, when the artist is alive in any person, whatever the kind of work may be, he becomes an inventive, searching, daring, self-expressing creature. He becomes interesting to other people. He disturbs, upsets, enlightens, and he opens ways for better understanding. It's so good. I mean, like the world would stagnate without the artist. And he just talks about how, it's sort of like what you're saying, Jake, in a different kind of way though, like that you're ready for battle and to be an artist really means being alive because you have to respond to something. It's not just about creating things out of nothing. It's about seeing something, realizing you want to express something about it and which angle are you going to express? And you know, are you hitting that? And it's a battle to hit that every time. You know, maybe you do a nice painting, but it doesn't hit that level that you thought it would. It doesn't have the reaction that you thought it would get, not in terms of likes and all the Instagram stuff, but I'm saying just hitting that emotional core. And that's really what he's talking about, is being alive and responding to the work. And that's what he always comes back to, is the work. And I think too often in our society now, we talk about the business and we talk about the social media and we talk about all this stuff. And you know, every time I'm feeling overwhelmed by all that stuff, I always come back to the work.
Mm, that's cool. Yeah, I'm put that one on the list for sure.
It's good.
My next reading. Cool. Will, did you have anyone you wanted to add to this?
You know, for inspiration for art, so I look at books for inspiration for business and for art. So for the art side, definitely, I'm pulling from more children's books, you know. I haven't actually read a book that got me inspired to make art, but when I find a book of art that I love, I want to get busy, so I can just read a really quick list of those. Okay. Early on in my college years, I was a Steve Johnson and Mary Grand Prix super fan. You know, right. Frog Prince Continued by Steve Johnson. I really love the book Chin Yu Min and the Ginger Cat by Mary Grand Prix. Mm-hmm.
I can see your influence, those books' influence. I had those books too in college. You? I definitely see you as you know, that's still living in your brain somewhere.
I was so jealous of Steve Johnson. I actually talked to him one time. I just had to call him up and just kind of gush. Lane Smith, a big Lane Smith fan. True Story of the Three Little Pigs and Big Pets. And a David Catro fan. David Catro was a cartoonist who also found children's books and has done a ton of children's books. And
yeah, I'm not even gonna see. He was also a political cartoonist.
Yeah, too. Yeah. Just absolutely love his stuff.
I got to work with him.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah,
he that's came right. On you said for, that. Yeah,
for a little while at for Horton Hears a Who.
Yeah. Was it? What did you think of him?
Nice guy. Yeah.
How can you say anything else right now? You're on the podcast.
I didn't care for him. Take him or leave
super
him.
Super lame.
No, when I see other artists, in fact, like if I want to make an image sometimes for inspiration, I just get on Pinterest mm-hmm. and just go nuts, you know, and pretty soon I'm like, okay, I am fueled up and ready to go.
Time to go. I mean, are you saying to yourself when you're watching, looking at Pinterest, like I need to make something that would equal the caliber of this?
Yes, or, yeah, exactly.
That's kind of like, what I do too.
Because it's intimidating, right? You're seeing the best of the best of the best.
I'll show you guys a funny image based on that same thing. So what you're basically saying is, you know, you compile these visual inspirations and then it forces you to go off and make your own thing. Before I was an artist, because I came to art so late, I was seeing things throughout my life, but it never translated probably like it did for you guys, where you said, oh, I'm going to use that in my drawing. Or that's a new mm-hmm. thing that I'll try in my painting. For me, I just had this like spark of feeling and nothing to do with that feeling for a long time. So one of those was A Nightmare Before Christmas came out and I hadn't even picked up a pencil yet when that came out. And so, you know, that scene where it's the all the different seasonal trees together, you know, those four Christmas tree yeah. and the, you yeah. know, it's all the wood on the ground. Such a weird choice for that ground. And I just remember sitting in the theater going, like bells going off when that was on the screen and I had nothing to do with it. You know, fast forward to when I finally got to Art Center and I was loving on Joe Soren. And then, but that image from Nightmare Before Christmas stuck. I'm going to send you guys an image real quick. I know you guys listening to the podcast can't see this, but this is the exact combination of Joe Soren and that scene in Nightmare Before Christmas. Do you see it? I sent it to you with the text. I'll put it in the show notes if you guys want to see it. So this is what I was probably a sophomore in college when I did this. Isn't it like the exact mix of those two references? Like both of those people, like when I saw Joe Soren, the bells were going off as being like, I need to go in this direction. And Nightmare Before Christmas just sat in there for years. And I remember making this image, and from this image on, you know, you have those pivotal images that then all of a sudden you're sort of different after you make them, and you'd never know when those are going to happen. Right. And this one was definitely one of those.
Huh. That's cool.
That's great. Okay, so inspiration. Now, business, are there any books that you've read or resources that you've gone to like help you be a better business person or a... I guess influenced your business understanding of business or I guess how you might go about doing business as an illustrator.
Yes.
Yes. Let's hear it.
Okay. So to me, there are two different types of business books. I put them in two different categories mm-hmm. and that is, you know, the first kind I probably would never read, which is like how to do your taxes and how to do invoicing and how to do like,
right.
you know, maintain an office. And so when I'm talking about business, that stuff, I'm not that interested in. I don't think I could make it through a book that's very technical and I would maybe use one as a reference, but I mean, we've got Google, so I'm kind of more, you know, what I want to read our mindset type books, mm-hmm. books that will change my mindset in as far as expanding it, as far as giving me ideas that I had never really considered. And I don't read a whole lot, so I'm just going to say that up front. But the ones that I've really stuck out to me that really made a difference were three books that I still use the principles in there today. And those are Linchpin by Seth Godin, A Whole New Mind by Daniel Pink, and 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. Mm. So basically, you know, to distill Linchpin from Seth Godin, the idea in there that that really stuck home was, or which that he drove home was, as an artist especially. I mean, he's speaking to artists, and basically though, in that book, he's saying that everyone has an art side to them. So you know, it's not like either or. You know, we all have some left brain in us. We all have some logical, and we all have some creative. And he really talks a lot about the mix that, you know, we're usually left or right brain dominant, usually more creative, more logical. But all of us can draw on our art side in no matter what we do, no matter what profession we're in. So he's not just speaking to visual artists. He's speaking to everybody, with a brain who can tap into their art side. But one of the main things that he says in that book is, that you're unique, and your uniqueness allows you, if you develop it, to create unique products. And if you create unique products, then rather than competing with the person, you know, a lot of what you would call entrepreneurs or business people that don't create something on their own, a lot of people try to resell what someone else has created, which is much more difficult because they have competition from the creator of that product selling to other people, selling the exact same product, right? But he's saying you as an artist, you know, no one can sell what you have except you or who you grant the rights to, but you own the IP. And there's a ton more in there, but he really talks about becoming indispensable, and how people are going to succeed, and the basically the cocktail they need to succeed in this modern world. And he really says, you know, a lot of artists are going to prevail if they just realize their potential and what they can do on their own and what they can create. So he's ventures way into becoming an entrepreneur in that book. A Whole New Mind by Daniel Pink. He talks about how artists are relied upon. It really expanded my mind as far as like seeing art in everything, and every single thing that we desire in this world that we want, from be it, you know, going out to eat, to vacations, to movies, to books, to any kind of entertainment, any kind of thing we want, cars, nice cars, everything has an art component to it. Every single thing that you value, your most prized possessions, almost always have an art component to them. So, and what's funny is, yet you have this, if you told your parents as a kid that you wanted to be an artist, they'd go, oh, you know, there's this whole, you know, idea of starving artists. And that's because, you know, and he talks about that in there, that we haven't really learned to think of our art as and having the value that it does. You know, and basically, you know, you have to protect your art. You have to develop it, and then you have to figure out ways to monetize it and sell it where it's still, you know, it's, we have to get out of that starving artist mentality. And then of course the 4-hour work week, by Tim Ferriss is really looking at creating systems and creating, outsourcing some of the work that you don't like to do to other people. And because there's other people that are dying to work for you. And
I always think about that every time we do this podcast and I see somebody in the background of Jake, like packing something up to ship. Have you guys noticed? And then every time I've done, I'm like, you know, I should do that, get somebody to do that. And then 2 hours later, I'm stuffing my own prints. For 2 hours, and I'm like, come on.
Well, it's funny because I was thinking about this the other day. We were looking at, you know, some of the work that, you know, here at SVS, you know, obviously you guys know who've been following this podcast, that this podcast is kind of brought to you by svslearn.com, the online art education website that we created. And we realized that we weren't good at certain things. So we have people who are good working behind the scenes that do an amazing job. And it is, at first it was scary hiring them, for me, I'll speak for myself. Because, you know, you're like, well, then I'm going to make less money. Are we going to make enough to pay this employee to do this? But boy, has it been amazing.
That 4-hour work week, I read that about 10 years ago. And that one also, I think that's got me on the same wavelength as you, Will, as far as doing SVS, because the whole idea of that is there's ways that you can generate income that don't require you to be working 40 hours a week all the time.
Right.
And I looked at what I had been doing for my whole career up to that point and what I wanted to be doing moving forward. And I still work 40, 50, 60 hours a week, but I'm doing a whole lot more of what I want to do and not 40 hours for some other like employer who, you know, who's going to lay me off as soon as times get hard. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why I like this career path as an illustrator. I like what you said about Linchpin too, making your own IP and having something that I think the combination of those two things, Linchpin and 4-Hour Workweek, can make a huge mind shift for a person, because it makes you think about what can I make that I own myself and how can I sell it so that I'm making money even when I'm out playing or I'm over here working on something completely different. Cool. What about you, Lee?
Those are good. I've mildly dipped into the 4-hour work week. And I like what he's saying, but I've never finished it for some reason, cause I'm too busy. So I need to finish it so I can not be busy to read it. along the same lines.
I think
lines,
a lot of these books though, you could probably find the, 45 page summary of them and get the same gist. A lot of the filler is just, stories. It's like story time, which just drive a point home even deeper. So if you want that, if you need that, then read the book. But if you just want to get straight to like the gist of it,
yeah.
Every one of these,
I'll do the audio book too.
Yeah, there you go.
Modern day reading is the audio book. Along the same lines, I guess, as those, one of the biggest mind shift ones I've read is Deep Work by Cal Newport. We've talked about it before. I don't know if we've talked about it much on the podcast. I know we did on the previous version, whatever that was before we were doing this. It's if you guys haven't heard of it, I know Jake's read it. I don't know about you, Will, but it's amazing. It really talks about, you know, in the modern age of absolute distraction. I mean, that's all the world is right now with your phones and your watches and everything, all this stuff, and messaging and social media all connected. There will be a currency value to being able to turn all that off and work in a deep way where you're making meaningful work. And the only way to do that is to have a system in place to separate yourself from all those quick distractions and then hopefully ending up with a satisfying artistic career. I mean, that's like the ultimate goal, not necessarily making money again from this one, but it's just like making the work that you want to make in a way that's enjoyable. And like you were saying, or I guess Will was saying it a second ago, with there's art in everything. That's sort of what they talk about here, is that if you, anything you do that you focus on can be enjoyable, whether that's a walk or doing the dishes or cooking a meal or making artwork, if you turn off all the distractions. But I found more and more and more as time goes by, I'm like just like firing on all this different stuff. Oh, there's something over here. I better check my email. And it's just a constant string of distractions. Mm-hmm. And this book really does talk about how to do it and what the benefits of getting rid of all that stuff and picking something and really diving into it.
Yeah,
it's really good.
That's a dang good book. Cause that one also gave me a huge shift too. Just I was so reliant on social media, and I have these just not just for business side of things, but just to fill in all the blanks during my day. Like, oh, I'm bored. I cannot have a minute to my thoughts. I better go check what someone's saying on Twitter, you know, or what somebody posted on. And after reading that book, it made me realize like, okay, you need to chill out, Jake Parker. And one of the things he talks about, and then he has a follow-up book called, Digital Minimalism. where he gets into that like a little bit deeper, like how can you be a digital minimalist? And his whole thing is that your brain needs time to just think. Mm. It can't be constantly processing inputs. It needs time to take everything that it's experienced and turn it over and mulch, you know, mulch it and spin the mulcher, right? And just kind of, and since then I've been like, okay, let's do that every day. Let's have some time where we just don't, you know, we're not always focused on what's going on out there. And there's actually this year off and on, I've been deleting social media off of my phone.
I'll go too.
A couple of weeks without it, and then I'll put it back on. I'll have a Kickstarter, or I'll have, you know, some project where I just need to be in contact and doing things, and then I'll take them off, and it'll be like 3 weeks, or not 3 weeks, but like 3 days before I think to check Instagram on my iPad, and I'll be like, oh yeah, and I realize just how much I don't need it. So
right, yeah, one of the greatest quotes in that book is, do I want to be good? He was talking about this person who literally just stopped answering email. His autoresponder is, I'm not answering your email. If you want to get in touch mm-hmm. with me, write me a letter. And the reasoning behind that was, do I want to be good? And I think this person was a writer. So do I want to be a good writer, or do I want to be good at answering emails? Because you're going to get good at whatever you do a bunch of.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So
yeah, I forgot about that because I totally changed my contact page on my website because of that. I just basically said, here, you can contact me. Chances are I am not going to reply, but I do appreciate everything. If it is urgent, put urgent in the title and I will get back to it. And I'll read it within 24 hours. I still might not reply, but I'll read it in 24 hours. And that actually, that made me feel so less self-conscious about all the emails I was getting. Mm. Yeah. Okay, cool. I have a couple books too for business. One is Real Artists Don't Starve by Jeff Goyens. And the other one is Perennial Seller by Ryan Holiday. Real Artists Don't Starve was a book that I read 2 years ago when it came out. And, or maybe it was a year ago. I can't remember. But I read it and I was like, gosh, dang it. This is the book I needed to read when I was 20. Not when I was 40, because I was doing everything, almost everything. There were some things where I was just like, oh yeah, I could fix this, I could fix that. But for the most part, I was doing everything that it said, but I came about it the hard way. Like it took me a while to figure these things out. And if I just came into it earlier on, I could have maybe have been a little bit more successful a little bit sooner. But one of the things he opens with is he talks about Michelangelo. And when Michelangelo died, he had like his assets, his wealth was something in the range of, in today's money, $42 million. And he owned properties. He, not to mention all the money that he made just from selling artwork, but he was renting out villas and stuff like that. And the thing was, is he digs into Michelangelo. And he just talks about like, this was a guy who made art, but he also was like a businessman about it. Like he found the right patrons who paid the right amount of money. And he took on the right projects, and he did all of the things right so that he could have the most financial impact with the projects that he did. And he was an outlier for sure, but he wasn't abnormal. Like artists in the Renaissance did fine. Like, like you could, basically they had these art, conglomerates or these art, like what would you call it? Like a guild, an art guild or something like that. And so if you wanted a portrait, you know, you're this rich person, you needed a portrait, you would go to this guild, and the guild had these prices set, like here's how much a portrait costs so that the artist has time and the right amount of money to do it. And then a portrait could take like a year to do it, but you'd be staggering these portraits. So you'd have, you know, four or five of them to do. And between all that, you'd have enough money to support yourself comfortably you know, for the year or whatever, right? And so something happened along the way in the 1800s where the starving artists, the art was supposed to be, you know, the real true artists were ones that like bled for their work and they traded art for, you know, crusts of bread and things like that. That's where that kind of came into existence, and we haven't been able to shake it. We still think about art as you know, we think about the starving artist, and his whole book is basically saying, nope, real artists don't starve. Real artists get paid well for their work. They work on stuff that they want to do, and here's how they do it. And so that was a good book. The next one was Perennial Seller.
And can I go back and add one thing to that last one? Because I remember you mentioned that book like 2 weeks ago when we were talking about different topics of we're going to do on the podcast. And you were talking about artists not starving and stuff. And I just read an article, and I meant to say something about it to you guys, but it's perfect for this. That, do you know what Shakespeare did for a living?
Oh, yeah. He talks about Shakespeare in his book, too. But go ahead.
He's a grain hoarder and a real estate guy. And he basically sort of price gouged when there was scarcity of grains, and he was a ruthless business dude, and you know, everybody loves to think of him as the, you know, almost iconic kind of, I don't want to say starving, but I think people would say, oh, he was just a writer and that's all he did, and he just did his work and he didn't care about his life, you know, in terms of business, but he did quite well.
Well, in the book it actually talks about how he owned the actual theater that all of his plays were in. So when he wasn't doing a play, he was renting it out to other production companies to do their plays.
He was a landlord.
Yeah. Dude, he is smart. Do you know he ran a Kickstarter for Romeo and Juliet? No, I'm just kidding.
No.
that's but crazy. He would have now.
He would have. And then the other one is Perennial Seller by Ryan Holiday. Ryan's a writer. He's written several like best-selling books. Not only that, but they're sort of like these timeless books that, you know, are between, you know, 5, 10, 15 years old, I think is his career at this point. And one of his books, The Obstacle is the Way, took 5 years to become like a bestseller. And since then, it's become like the go-to book for some reason, NFL teams and coaches to like read this book. Their teams read this book. That's Obstacles Away. But he, in his experience, he's like, I realized I wanted to make, I didn't want to make something that was just a hot like seller that would you know, blow everybody away and then be forgotten. I was much more interested in like the slow burn, the building the audience over the time, and the book that continues to sell 10, 20, 50, 100 years later. Mm-hmm. And he talks about these publishing houses who have these expensive rents in these buildings in Manhattan, you know, $1 million a month rent, stuff like that. And what's actually paying their bills are To Kill a Mockingbird, the Dr. Seuss Library.
Wow.
You know, like all of these books that Citizen Kane and, oh no, that was a film. What was the other one? Catcher in the Rye, stuff like that. All these books that libraries and schools and people are just continually buying multiple copies year after year because a student needs to read it, or it's just a good book and you want to brush up on a classic, or you know, a librarian recommends it, stuff like that. And so his book, Perennial Seller, is how do you make a book that is a perennial seller? And the first half of the book is how do you make something timeless? And it's all about the craft, like how do you research your project? How do you align with what people need to hear, with what you want to write, stuff like that. And then the last half of the book is how do you sell this book? How do you build a platform to sell a book on? How do you promote the book? How do you have it do the slow burn where it builds an audience year after year over time? So I would recommend definitely that book. That book was a real eye opener for me as well.
Very cool.
Okay, last section, we talked about what inspired us growing up. We've talked about what inspires us now, what has guided us business-wise, and what should every illustrator read or have in their library or use as reference as far as craft, like how to get better at the actual craft of art. Will, you were telling me one book earlier. You want to get into that?
Yeah, I'm not really good on this particular section because I didn't read a lot of books. But one that really came across my desk, and this was after I was a professional, was Framed Ink by Marcus Mateo. Mm-hmm. And I have recommended that book a lot. If you're, for anyone who is wanting to get better at composition, and one thing that I constantly preach, design is one of my all time favorite things to do as an illustrator. I say this a lot that a lot of artists are good at drawing, but they don't learn how to design. And if you feel like you can't sit down and just come up with a really good composition, that probably means that you need to work on that aspect. And I see a lot of artists avoiding that. And I would say, anything that you avoid that you need to do is just going to prolong the agony. So right. Check out Framed Ink. It's a really good book on composition.
And Lee, what about you?
I got some good ones. Go through them real quick. I agree with Will. This one is called Universal Principles of Design. I'm like Will. I like to go back. I don't like books that say, here's how to make a painting, and it starts you from like an acrylic or something like that, like the medium painting books. I don't really like those. I like it when it gets back to just basic principles that make no matter what I'm doing better, whether it's digital or acrylic or watercolor or oil or whatever. This Universal Principles of Design book just talks about all these ways. It says 100 ways to enhance usability, influence perception, increase appeal, and make better design decisions, and ultimately being able to teach design. So I got it as a teacher, but it's fantastic. It just goes through all these different principles of design. It's not necessarily just illustration. I used it actually for remodeling my house too. Like, how do I make good decisions that enhance the look of my house versus take away? And so it works in all these different kind of base level design ways. I mean, that's always the question, right? Is how, if somebody says, okay, I need to be a better designer. Well, how do I know if I'm a better designer? How do I get there? Is there, something that can weigh that? There was a book that I had when I was, struggling in school. I minored in industrial design, and there was always something that, when I'm walking through the halls of Art Center, that the industrial design drawings looked a certain way. I don't even know what the adjective is. It's like, it's industrial design. Designy. And I was like, how are all these, but almost everybody's drawing the exact same way, and it all looks designy and cool. And I just didn't know, coming at it fresh, I didn't know even how to describe what that is until I found this book. It's called Drawing and Designing with Confidence, a Step-by-Step Guide. And it is literally exactly how to make industrial design kind of drawings. And what's great about it is it goes through each thing. And there's one principle that I took from this book that I actually use in all my, when I teach now. And that's, I just come up with a name for every single thing. Like, he's got this line, it's called a hit-go-hit line. And that's where you start slow, you speed up, and then you slow down. It's kind of the effect that a pen will have. If you do that, you get a dark edge, and then it lightens in the middle and then darkens towards the end. And if you just do that, your drawings will start to look designy. And there's all these little things that he goes over, and he labeled all of them. He came up with names for each one of them. So there's a principle that he's talking about, and then he named it. And so you can kind of almost go through as a checklist to doing that. And how that transferred to my clumsy illustration style is I was able to do the same thing. Like, now I want a scratchy, uneven line versus a smooth, controlled line. And, so I labeled everything, and that's how I'm able to kind of move between these different styles pretty easily.
That's cool. I had no idea that book existed.
Oh, it's so good.
That's awesome.
I had to catch up, so I needed something.
Yeah. In the same vein as that, like, I think if you want to be good at illustrating, you have to be good at drawing. You just have to have drawing chops first. And the book I recommend for that is How to Draw Drawing and Sketching Objects, Environments from Your Imagination by Scott Robertson and Thomas Bertling. And this book is the book that I pulled a lot of ideas and information from this book for my How to Draw Everything course. That course was like a mix between stuff I'd learned working for animation studios, stuff I learned from this book, and just stuff I picked up as a as an artist as well. But what's great about this book is it teaches you step by step, like here's how you make a line at the very first chapter. Here's how you do lines. By the end of it, you're drawing like an airplane with like different angled wings at a 3/4 degree, like perspective warped angle, right? So you go from, you know, if you do every single lesson in this book, and it might take you a year to get through it or 2 years to get through it, but if you go through it, like he shows you in a very logical, methodical, step-by-step process, like, okay, now you've got a line. Here's how you make a square. Here's how you do a square in perspective. Here's how you extrude that square and make a box. And he just keeps going and going. Here's how you add shapes. Here's how you subtract shapes. Here's how you do round shapes. Here's how you do perspective, like all this stuff. So I definitely recommend that book to get better at drawing, specifically drawing objects. And then if you want to, mine's going to be a 1-2-3 punch for drawing and creating. So now if you want to be able to draw humans or figures, the book I recommend is Figure Drawing, Design, and Invention by Michael Hampton. And this guy isn't so much concerned that you can do life drawing so much as that you can, without looking at a model, draw a character running, or draw a character reaching for something or jumping over something. And he shows you how all the muscles work together, but in such a basic design sense. So you don't have to have like a biologist's understanding of anatomy to be able to draw the human. You just have to have like a designer's understanding of anatomy. So he breaks all the main body muscle shapes down to like their core basic shapes, and then shows you how to piece them together to pose a character in whatever pose you want them to do. So that's a good book. So now you know how to draw objects, you know how to draw humans, but then what do you actually draw to make them interesting and cool to look at? And I recommend Imaginative Realism by James Gurney. And James Gurney created Dinotopia. He's illustrated countless National Geographic magazines. And he's just an amazing craftsman and painter, and he builds models of, you know, if he's got to draw a dinosaur, he'll actually build a model of the dinosaur so he can get the lighting right so that the painting can look like accurate, and that's how he goes about it. And so in this Imaginative Realism book, he walks you through all of his process of how do you draw something and create something that does not exist, that you can't just pull up reference for. And that's what that book's completely, entirely about. And it's really, really good.
He's such a good artist, in my opinion. He's a great teacher, which everybody's not, you know, who's a good artist doesn't necessarily translate to being a great teacher. But I think he's such a good artist. And my criteria for that is anybody who can paint like a parking lot at Home Depot and somehow it looks fantastic. That's a good artist, man.
He'll just set up his plein air. He doesn't go out to the mountains. He just goes to the Circle K.
It's incredible. Like,
look at the sun, how it hits the sign. Now, don't forget, you know, he really is. He like calms my blood pressure whenever I watch his videos. Did you know he went to school with Thomas Kincaid? That they were buddies?
I did know that.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people that went to school with Thomas Kincaid. You know, Thomas Kincaid, you know the story of Thomas Kincaid, that he was just an amazing artist. Yeah. You guys know about that? He was like the envy of everybody. Yeah. Steve Houston was
amazing artist,
with him too.
Prolific too. Like I read this, maybe this is another book I should recommend, but I read this biography on Thomas Kincaid. It's basically like, here's how you become a billionaire being an artist. But also here's a cautionary tale of how you do not drink yourself to death, more or less. But what was cool about that is he basically made a way for him that he had to do at least 12 like finished, beautiful, large paintings every year. So basically every month he had to crank one of these like scenes out. And the process, the logistics to be able to do that and stick with it. Like the dude just painted all the stinking time, always painting and painting and drinking. It's kind of was his thing. Anyways, yeah, he's a mixed bag. That's for sure. Kind of a jerk, but also kind of like a good, he was a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type of character, you know. It was really interesting.
We need to, but nobody has copied that business model where you open a store, you sell prints, and then you train the person working there just to add highlights to it.
For real, huh?
No, nobody else has done that. I mean, and he had stores everywhere and they were very, very successful and he sold a ton of them, making literally millions, and not a single person followed.
Now, is money the only important thing as an artist, Lee?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, no.
Of course it is. I'm just saying, no. If you already have the art and then you can open a store and have somebody add a little bit of white to a light pole.
Mm-hmm. And let me play devil's advocate, though. But if he was doing those paintings once a month and doing nothing but painting and drinking, was the drinking because of this the schedule? You know what I mean? Like,
dude, that's a chicken and the egg kind of argument. I don't know.
Just saying, like,
he didn't live a great life. I mean, we know that.
Be careful what you ask for, because sometimes you'll get it.
Yeah. I do know that they actually they took a vial of his blood and mixed it with the ink that would go into the prints, so that every I'm not making
you are
this
lying.
Serious. Nope.
You are lying.
I've heard that, but how do we know that's not just
way?
It was in the book.
It was in the book.
Wait, so say that again. They mixed his blood with ink. And did what with it?
I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to go read it again, and we'll get into this next podcast.
Well, I need to change my whole business. I need to change my whole business model now after the past 5 minutes.
I'm gonna make sure it's verified and it's real, because it does. Now that I'm talking about it, I'm like, wait, did I actually read that? Or was that a fever dream?
You just made that up. I heard that his ghost still goes around and paints highlights on things. It's in the book.
The ghost of Thomas Kincaid.
Wow.
All right. Should we wrap this up?
It's definitely time to wrap
it up. Let's keep going. Hold on. I want to recommend one more book. We do a lot of picture book stuff, this one's a really good one. Again, going back to the idea of basic shapes and basic principles. It's called Picture This, How Pictures Work by Molly Bang. Mm-hmm. What I love about this book is every image, she basically used the basically icons of Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf and some trees. And so, and handled them in a very graphic way. Jake and Will, you said you're not familiar with this one.
Oh, I have that. I've taught with it. I love that book.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, they basically use just a triangle, a red triangle for Little Red. And then the wolf is similarly basic shapes. And they just say, okay, if you want the wolf to feel threatening, here's how these shapes work. And if you want him to feel, it's so good.
I would go as far as saying this. If you're an illustrator and you buy this book and you don't like it, it's exactly the book you need. Because it's the medicine you need, because you got into illustration for drawing. You like to draw. This says, put your drawing away for just a second. Mm-hmm. We know you can draw. Right. Now, digest this book and try to understand the value in it. If you can understand the value in that book, it's going to make your drawing. It'll enhance your drawing because you'll have good design. Yeah.
Perfect cool. Wrap.
I got to get that one. I got to get it. I got to check it out. Okay.
You need it, Jake.
Ouch.
Okay, thanks for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And we do mean that. Several of great illustrators who are working professionals out there now got their start taking classes from SVS Learn. It's so cool to see these people go on to get book deals, to see their books on the bookshelves at the store, at the bookstores or at the airport. I saw one at the airport. It was really cool. So we teach all about the craft, the business of it, how to make the art and how to get your work out there and seen by other people. So check out svslearn.com. Now's a good time to join on too, because we've got the foundations courses that we're cranking out classes for. And these classes teach you the basic foundations of what you need to learn to become a good illustrator. And by the end time you go through these foundations, you actually have a portfolio that you can then build on and use to go get work. Okay, so your hosts have been Will Terry, Lee White, and I'm Jake Parker. Will Terry can be found at willterry.com. You can also find him on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White is at leewhiteillustration.com and on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And I can be found at mrjakeparker.com and also on Instagram at jakeparker. Podcast is produced by Aaron Painter. Thank you, Aaron, for all you do. His website is painterdraws.com. Podcast edited by Alex Sugg. And his work can be found at alexsugg.com, and that's Sugg with two G's, S-U-G-G.com. Podcast video is edited by Daniel Two. It's daniel2.co. It's his website. Check him out there. Two is spelled with a T and a U. So that's daniel2.co. And podcast shared online, and our social media specialist is Lisa Fott. Thank you for all that you do, Lisa. I think that's it. If you like this episode, you probably want links to all these books. So if you go read in our show notes, we've got links to where you can get these books on Amazon, and hopefully Amazon shipping by now. And, if you like this episode, you could share it around as well. That's how podcasts live and die, is by word of mouth. We appreciate any good word of mouth we can get for this podcast. So share it on Twitter, share it on Facebook, share it on Instagram. We really do appreciate that. And I think that's it. We love you guys. We'll catch you later. And we'll see you next time. Bye.